Welcome back to another episode of the How To Fitness podcast, and we had the amazing opportunity this week to speak with an incredible guest, respected Cambridge University lecturer, Dr. Giles Yeo. You may recognize him from his many BBC documentaries or his books, Gene Eating and Why Calories Don't Count, or from his recent interview on Diary of a CEO, which caused quite a bit of controversy in the fitness industry.
Dr. Yeo is a professor of molecular neuroendocrinology whose research focuses on food intake, genetics, and obesity, and our conversation was nothing short of amazing. So let's get to it. Hello and welcome back to the How Do Fitness podcast. I'm Kate Lyman.
And I'm Michael Yejoa.
And we're here with a really, really exciting guest today, Dr. Giles Yeo. I'm overwhelmed. With how cool you are, with how much you know, and with how much I want to talk about.
So you know what? Let's just this is called pressure. I think we need to make sure and let people listen first, and then say, he wasn't that amazing. So let's see. Thank you for having me on. Okay.
A very high bar. No, honestly, Giles, thank you so much. I recently introduced you to Kate, and she has just loved your stuff ever since, which is amazing. I've known you for many years and have always loved your content you create, the message you put out there. I think it's a really nice, healthy balance between evidence-based, but then treating people like real human beings around that as well. And I think that's really important. So if we're completely honest, we were a little bit overwhelmed of like what we wanted to talk to you about today, because there are so many different avenues that we could take this. And I know that whatever value you provide us today is going to be amazing for our listeners. So another massive thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
And first, I think we want to hear about this cycling trip you just did, because I follow you on Threads. Because, you know, like when I pop over to Threads, I don't know what's going to come up, but your daily updates on your cycling trip always popped up. And I was like, that looks so fun. I want to know more about this.
So this is in, this is my midlife crisis cycle. So I just, this is in lieu of buying a Porsche, right? So I turned 50 this year in May. And I thought, what am I going to do, right? Rather than just blow a couple of candles out on a cake, or many candles out on a cake, what am I going to do? And I'm a keen cyclist. I'm a cyclist, I don't race. I love cycling, road cycling. And so I thought, you know what? I want to do one of these epic rides. And so I did this. It's about 1,100 miles, plus or minus, and it's the length of the UK. And we did it over 14 days, but old man style, meaning that someone moved my bags and we had hotel rooms or B&Bs anyway. But it was a supported ride. But I did have to pedal, and so it was roughly speaking about 75, maybe 80 miles every day on average for 14 days. And I did it. I signed up for this a while ago. I really, really enjoyed it. But I thought I would science this as well. So you know how there's now increasing use of these continuous glucose monitors, but not for diabetics, for wellness, etc., etc. So I'm plugged in at the moment to the matrix for this. You
can't see. Oh, you're still going. Okay.
I'm still going. And so what I did was I did compare two different, unfortunately, the second one fell off. We'll leave that alone halfway through the ride. But to compare two different continuous blood glucose monitors, just recorded stuff I ate, et cetera, et cetera. I fell over, went to A&E, and just under some stress just to actually record it. And it was, first of all, the ride was surreal because in fact, I'm slightly, don't know what to do with myself because I'm not cycling at the moment. It's sort of like, I think, what being in the military would be like. You were told when to wake up. You were told when to eat. You were told when to meet at the van with your bags and when to start cycling. And it was just the most fabulous, the most fabulous experience. There were physically tough days. There were mentally tough days. And interestingly, they did not coincide. The physically tough days were not my mentally toughest days. That tended to coincide with the weather. And the blood glucose monitors just picked up some interesting things. It was very surreal. I'm still a bit of in shock that I'm back. I'm still in shock that I actually finished it I've never done anything like that before. I commute quite a way, but nothing like 80 miles a day for 14 days. I mean, for me, it's certainly an unusual thing to do.
It's a really cool trip. I I now really want to do it. So you've added it to my list, Giles. So thank you so much for inspiring me. What was out of interest, obviously being a Scottish resident, I'm kind of hoping you say somewhere up here. What was the most beautiful part of your cycle?
Glencoe. So it was when we went from Tindrum, which is let's start this again. Not Tindrum. It's when we went from Fort Augusta. Where is? Yeah. Tindrum, where the Green Welly is. North of Glasgow. Tindrum to Fort Augustus. And we went through Glencoe, which is, Glen is Scottish for valley. And so it was the Valley of Coe, in effect. And it was one of the most, I'm not a particularly spiritual human being, but oh my God, if I believed in God, that was the day to believe in God. I was going, geez, what is this? What is this? And I've driven that drive, which takes you into, it's like the entrance to the Highlands. From if you drive from Glasgow, it takes you to the Highlands. That's the entrance to the Highlands. I've driven it many times because I've been to Scotland for vacation, what have you. But and I've walked it, actually. So I've walked elements of it. I wild camped and actually walked it. But it was just so different doing it on a bike because it was sort of like walking. You see the same view for a long time because you're not moving very quickly. Driving, you're not looking at a view at all. You're just trying to avoid killing somebody. And you sort of, whereas cycling gives you just views that change, but yet you are just there and really, really there. And plus the fact you got to climb and descend and climb and descend. So you're breathing hard as well. It was just the most amazing day. I know, sorry, this sounds slightly, I feel like an evangelical, a Southern Baptist preacher. But, oh man, if you guys want to do one experience in your life, cycling through Glencoe was one of the best days of my life.
Right, Kate, you got to get a trip over here.
Done. It's got to be on the bucket list now.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Is a good way to navigate a midlife crisis.
Thank you. Thank you. I thought it was okay. A couple of things. Clearly, I can't afford a Porsche anyway, if I wanted to. But B, I felt that by buying I also bought a new carbon bike, which is obviously, that's my Porsche.
That's as much as a Porsche, right?
That's as much as a Porsche. And critically, it sequesters carbon. This is my view, right? It's taking carbon from the air and putting it in the form of a bike. This is my excuse. This is what I told my wife.
Okay. Perfect. Right. Let's bring it round to fitness then. Let's keep the fitness chat going.
Okay.
So Giles, you specialize in kind of genetics and body weight. This is kind of your area of expertise. And hearing you speak about this is fascinating. And within the fitness industry, there's still a very common held belief of big body, unhealthy and lazy, small body, fit and healthy. And it's a thing that both Kate and I are challenging and trying to talk a lot about on this podcast. And there seems to be kind of an incredible oversimplification of body size and body weight. And I'm wondering if you could just kind of explain your thoughts a little bit on this stance and how much does genetics kind of play its role in the size of someone's body? I know that's quite a broad question there.
It's quite a broad question. Let me tackle the first half first, then we'll go into the genetics.
Of course.
Okay, mm-hmm. We'll go into the genetics. And I think this is a crucial fact. So I guess a good question to start with is, what does obesity mean? Okay. Now, some people use a number. Some people say it's BMI above 30. And well, that may be the clinical sort of like explanation for when you have obesity is a BMI above 30. But that actually is just a number and means very little to the individual. On average, this is true. Okay. But to the individual sat in front of you, you guys are obviously practitioners and see people and give advice to people. So what I think a more helpful definition of obesity is carrying too much fat that it begins to influence your health, okay? Now, then the question is, how much fat is too much fat, okay? And that, I guess, is the interesting question because that differs from person to person. We'll get to the genetics of that in a second. But so just briefly, people think that when you gain weight and lose weight, you gain fat cells and lose fat cells. And that's just not true, okay? Your fat cells are like balloons. They get bigger when you gain weight and they get smaller when you lose weight. Sort of like muscle cells, okay? You don't gain muscle cells. Your muscle cells get bigger, broadly speaking, okay? And the safest place to store fat is in your fat cells because they're your the professional fat-storing organs. And therefore, that's a good place to actually store your fat. It's when they're not in fat, but actually goes outwards, they leak out, so to speak, and go into your muscle, your liver. That's when it actually causes problems. Okay. But the really interesting thing is all of us, you, me, have different amounts of fat that we can store safely. So famously, East Asian people, people that look like me, South Asian people, Bangladeshis, Indians, Pakistanis, okay, we don't have to get that large, at least amount of fat, before we tilt, before we increase our risk for type 2 diabetes, for example, okay? Whereas white people, Polynesians famously, for example, can actually get a lot larger before they suddenly increase their risk of metabolic disease, okay? So that's the base level, okay? So here's the thing. All of us have a safe fat-carrying capacity. We have the an amount of fat we can store safely on board. For some people, it's a lot. For other people, it's really not a lot at all, because you get skinny people with type 2 diabetes and larger people without type 2 diabetes and are perfectly metabolically, at least, healthy. And so I guess that is the answer. Because your genetics influences how much fat you can store safely, really quite a lot, okay? Just looking at someone's weight, just looking at someone's size, cannot tell you how healthy they actually are. And I think that is the that is the crucial thing. Now, I'm not talking morbid, severe obesity where someone has to cut a hole in your roof and helicopter you out, okay? I don't think anyone is saying that that's actually good for you. But on this cycle ride we were just talking about, okay? Now, all of us finished the ride, okay? Now, all of us finished at different speeds. But by its very definition, if you can finish 1,100 miles on a bicycle, I think you can say you are fit, okay? You may not be an Olympic athlete, but I think even if you have a bit of a tummy, and even though you would not be your BMI 29 or whatever like that, but you finish, I think you're doing okay. And so that would be my my explanation for why I think that actually body size is just a number. You need to see how you're holding your weight and how much fat you're carrying, and does it influence your health?
So I am a PhD dropout, but for a short amount of time in my PhD, I was studying social and behavioral science in public health nutrition, long title. And some of my research was working with metabolically healthy obese individuals and looking at lifestyle factors that contributed, or not contributed, but lifestyle factors that were more prevalent in this population of MHO individuals. But because I worked in behavioral science, we focused on this lifestyle and behavioral factors, and we didn't focus on genetics, right? Because that's so outside of my scope. But I guess what I'm taking from here is that's far more genetics-based than lifestyle-based, right? Because it's relevant to how much body fat we can hold without incurring disease.
Exactly. So now there are two elements. There are two elements there. So how much fat you can store safely, okay, is going to be almost purely genetic. Almost. Okay. Like it doesn't matter how much you exercise. It doesn't influence really how much fat you can store safely. Now, how large you are, how much food you actually end up eating. Now that will have some genetic influence. But clearly the environment will also play a role, right? Clearly, if you're more active, then you're going to do that. And so there are going to be different elements there. But just by the pure question of, are you someone who's likely to develop diabetes if you're skinny or if you need to be really quite large? That is an almost purely genetic question. It is also your body shape is also another very purely genetic thing. So do you have a big bum? Do you have a big tum? Do you kind of look like a sausage, right? And that is where you put your fat. So where you put your fat is related to how much fat you can carry safely, you know, apple shape versus pear shape, that kind of question. That is also almost entirely purely genetic, right? So because you can be skinny and have a big bum, or you can be fat and have a big bum. Your body shape is still there. So it is a nuance, because some people say, they try and argue back, there's no genetics in this, there's no genetics in that. And there's some elements that are very genetic, and there's some other elements, your environment, your lifestyle then plays a far bigger role in where you end up.
That's really, is there a way of telling how much is genetics and how much is lifestyle and environment? Is there a way that you can tell or not?
There is. So the way, the way that a lot of these, this is called heritability. This is the definition of heritability, is the variation of any given trait. We're talking about body weight and metabolic traits here, obviously, but it doesn't matter. It can be likelihood of me going bald, my eye color, freckles, whatever. But if we actually look at the heritability of human traits, the vast majority of human traits that we now understand to have a heritable nature, in fact, all of them do, it's just how much the role the environment plays, have come from twin studies, okay? So large cohorts of twins, you have identical twins who are, for all intents and purposes, genetic clones of each other. And then you have non-identical twins. And they would share as much material, genetic material, as you would with your own siblings or your parents, 50%. And so if you study a large enough population of twins, like tens of thousands of twin pairs, then you can say, well, what happens when you share 100% of your genes versus 50% of your genes? And then you begin to take apart the various characteristics, right? And so if we then talk about just two examples. So my hair, if I had hair, my hair would be black, okay? Now, hair color is something that is very powerfully genetically influenced with very little environmental impact. And I'm not talking about dyeing hair. I'm just talking natural hair color, okay? So we understand that. Whereas freckles, okay? Now, whether or not the likelihood of you getting freckles or how many freckles appear is clearly going to be genetically influenced. But whether or not they appear depends whether or not you stand in the sun. Do I like to wear T-shirts? You know, where do you live in the world, okay? And so that's an example of a genetically influenced trait with a very powerful environmentally influenced trait. So what we were talking about before, say fat-carrying capacity, a body shape, that goes towards the hair color side of things. Whereas actually, what kind of food we like to eat, how much we eat, will probably go more to the freckles, where there is definitely a genetic influence, but there is definitely an almost equal environmental influence as well. So that's how we worked it out, largely through the study of twins.
That's a fantastic example. That I feel like it just like really solidified a lot of things for me and how we can think about this. Because what a nuanced, complicated topic. Like our body weight is a product of a gazillion different factors. And it's interesting to know how those can all work together. Question for you about this like rising prevalence of genetic testing. Swab your cheek and mail it in, 23andMe, et cetera. Is there anything to actually pay attention to here? Specifically as far as our health or maybe dietary choices go? Because when I did 23andMe, I did it for the ancestry part. And then I realized I've never even looked at that other stuff because I assumed, maybe wrongfully, that it wasn't accurate. But I don't know.
So it depends what. Okay, without all the genetic testing companies do this. Okay, so this is not specific to 23andMe or Ancestry or DNA Fit or whatever. Whatever. All these testing companies are not lying. So just let me just get the T's and C's out in advance before I get sued. So it's one it's one of these things where the vast majority of these genetic testing companies are accurately getting your genetics right. Okay, because the technology is robust, et cetera, et cetera. So is it an A, a T, a G, or C? They get it right, okay? It's the interpretation, okay? And what they then do is all the interpretation is, largely speaking, based on published data, but it's A, the quality of the data that they're interpreting it from, and also how they use the data. And what these testing companies do is they merge traits that are very, very predictable using genes versus traits that are very, very, very unpredictable using genes because of the effect of the environment. So let me just give you a classic example. I've taken these tests a number of times now. The very, very first time I took it was because a newspaper wanted me to write a review on one of these testing companies. So I said, they're going to pay me to do it. So I said, well, how interesting. And I was expecting, like you, Kate, that this was all going to be a load of rubbish. But actually, a couple of things. I didn't realize. Now, I know you're going to look at me and says, how did I not know this? And it's one of these things where they said there was lactose intolerant. I'm going, no, I like pizza. So I called my mom. I said, Mom, you know, and she goes, yeah, well, of course you are. You can't drink that much milk. I'm going. And so my favorite poison in the morning, my caffeine poison in the morning, used to be a cappuccino. Okay. And so I said, oh. And so I did a crossover control. I switched to Americanos, just black coffee. and certain symptoms disappeared. I was going, whoa. And then I did the crossover control. I reintroduced the cappuccino and things. And it's terrible. Look what I study, okay? But yet, you get used to certain things in your life, shall we say. Mm-hmm. I'm lactose intolerant, but that is a fully predictable trait, okay? Because if you don't have, or you have the genetic variation within lactase, which is what you need to break down lactose, then as an adult, I can't break down. All of us can break down lactose as babies. We're mammals, but the gene gets shut off when we're older. But white people and certain other people have a genetic mutation that keeps the gene turned on all the time. Okay, this is just the way it works. So that's predictable. The other thing which is 100% predictable is my ability to drink alcohol. Now there, I know that I can drink some alcohol. Okay, whereas my dad can't even breathe the bubbles from champagne. Like when I graduated, he came, you know, our department held a thing and he felt the need to have a glass of champagne. He breathed the bubbles, he turned pink. He cannot drink at all. Okay. My mom, however, can enjoy a bit of red wine with dinner or whatever. And I practiced all the way through college. And so therefore I can drink quite a bit, but I can't drink as much as my white friends. And that's because, as it turns out, I only have one a real functioning copy of alcohol dehydrogenase, for example. Another very predictable thing. The problem is there are very few of these genetic variations that are predictable like this, okay, where you're looking at lactose, you're looking at alcohol, and therefore there is a metabolic pathway that actually breaks it down. But the moment you begin to do things like, I want to see the likelihood that you're going to respond to a Mediterranean diet. Now, wait a minute. Just everyone take a time out, right? The Mediterranean diet is a whole lifestyle. There's like a billion foods. How can you predict aerobic capacity? You're telling me you're going to be able to predict someone's aerobic capacity based on a couple of things? Come on. It's a complicated process. It's muscles, mitochondria, the whole thing. The issue is these companies mix all of these together. So you get your report. Okay. And in the nutrition element, it'll say lactose, it'll say alcohol, and you think, yeah, that's true, right? Because you know yourself. It says, ooh, that's really accurate, leading you to believe that everything else they say is accurate, okay? Mm-hmm. But the other thing is caffeine. That's also a single thing. Can you drink coffee or not? A lot of it. So suddenly they say, oh, your detoxification profile of your liver, bollocks, okay, is this because of that, or your ability to respond to this kind of diet or that kind of diet. Then, but I understand this because I look into this and I understand it. You guys probably understand it as well because you guys actually work in nutrition and fitness, et cetera, et cetera. But Joe Schmo, Jane Doe, off the street taking a test is going to say, they knew I was lactose intolerant. So maybe they're absolutely right. I shouldn't be eating a Mediterranean diet or whatever. That is the problem, I think, with these genetic tests. They're mixing very predictable traits, a few of them, sprinkling them in amongst the entire report, making it difficult for someone who is not au fait with the biology, because why would everyone, you know, not everyone's going to be, to try and really take apart some useful information. That's my problem with the tests.
On that is, so how do these companies get away with that or justify it? Is there like some research link showing that if someone's more intolerant to dairy or whatever, then they're likely to be intolerant to something else? Or how are they playing that?
So the example which I use is this. So imagine that, so what is true is that if you look at a large enough population, okay, millions of people, then if you have an A versus a G or T or C in this particular spot, you are more or less likely to respond to the Mediterranean diet or whatever, okay? You're more or less likely, but you sort of kind of need to look at a million people. And then you have an increased risk of 5%. But as a predictable thing, it's very difficult. Okay, so the analogy which I give to the medical students when I actually teach them here is this, okay? So a reproduction, okay, getting pregnant if you're a woman. We know a lot about reproduction, okay? Billions of women have got pregnant. We understand that if you're trying, the younger you are, the more likely you are to be pregnant. The older you are, the less likely. Menopause, the likelihood becomes zero. And you can draw a curve. Okay, so we know this. But yet, if you just take one piece of information, the woman's age, okay, there is no way in hell you're going to pick some random 34-year-old woman, for example, off the street and predict whether or not she can become pregnant, because she could be infertile for a myriad of different reasons, or she could be ovulating that day, so very high or somewhere in the middle. You can do biological tests to ask the question, right? What the likelihood of pregnancy is going to be. But the analogy is just taking an age, even though the younger woman is more likely to get pregnant, the older woman is not. Okay, this we understand. Just taking an age is difficult, impossible almost, to predict whether or not someone's going to become pregnant. That's the analogy. So if you're just going to do a few genetic markers about aerobic capacity, just as an example, which is a complex trait, yes, these variations, when taken into consideration with everything else, you could say, well, but just the genetics itself is uninformative.
Makes so much sense. And I feel like I have definitely approached that incorrectly by thinking that can't be true. I'm not going to look at any of it. Or there's no merit to any of that. But wow, I've learned a lot.
Because I do think there are some merits, and there are some simple rules, is a strong word. I don't like to use the word rules. But typically, if the trait that they're looking at involves one, for diets, okay, involves one single compound, alcohol, caffeine, lactose, the likelihood of it being true is higher because you're just dealing with one compound. Can you deal with this compound or not? You can draw biochemical, you can draw chemical reactions. How do I actually break this down? It's not always true, but it's far more likely to be true than if they give some complex traits such as aerobic capacity, response to a Mediterranean diet, et cetera, et cetera. And so I would do it and just look. And by all means, come back and ask me again. And I'm happy to look at your results, and we can go through it. But that is what I would do. I think it is useful. I think it's fascinating. And I think for those of you within the field, particularly the likelihood of people coming to you with this question to say, look, I've got my 23andMe test. This is what it says. What does it mean? And I think it's a lot easier for you to talk your clients through their results if they actually come and speak to you, if you've taken it yourself and sort of have a general sort of a vibe over what is likely to be true and what is just really impossible to predict just purely based on genes.
That's my goal today. I think 3andMe results.
I think you can expect an email from Kate within the next hour, maybe, Giles. Love it. Giles, so I really wanted to touch on this. So you were recently on Diary of a CEO podcast. How was that, by the way? Was it like a fun experience?
So, you know, the interesting thing about the Diary of a CEO is one of these things where somebody called me and says, would I like to be in this podcast? I sort of Googled it to make sure that I wasn't going on some Nazi, you know what I mean? You got to kind of do your homework. Yeah. And I recognized the guy. I said, oh, it's the guy from Dragon's Den, right? Who's like
Shark Tank.
Shark Tank it. And I said, sure. And so I showed up and I thought it was going to be sort of... this is no disrespect to the people in front of me here, but I just thought I was going to do a podcast, okay, where we were going to sit around, we were going to chit chat on microphones, and it was a cold day, and so I wasn't expecting to be filmed. And then what that happened was it went, and he had this whole surround, you know, he had a full studio set up. It was like a studio, and they recorded. That's the first thing that surprised me, the huge number of people that he hires just for the podcast. He has 20 people just wow. for the podcast. Okay, not everything that he hires full-time dealing with the podcast. And then he did the interview, which we're doing now, chit-chat. Okay, and it lasted, oh my God, an hour and 52 minutes. I hope this is not how long this is going to take, but an hour and 52 minutes.
You're safe, yeah.
Right? And I was expecting him then to edit it down to whatever, some podcasty length, hour, half an hour, you know, whatever, 45 minutes. He put the entire hour and 52 minutes out onto the interwebs. And then my phone exploded when it went out. And so the positive thing is it's good to see one's profile rise. Look, you know, we're not in the business to become necessary, but you know, if you want your message getting out, yeah. So this is a good thing. Yeah. But when you get millions of people watching these things, you're gonna get a small percentage of people, which of a few million people is a lot of people, commenting about you. And so I ended up being commented on my physical appearance. I know what I look like. You don't have to tell me. Okay, vis-a-vis my expertise in body weight. And they're going, well, shouldn't he be taking his own advice? You know, what is a guy with moves? I have less moves now, by the way, since I did the cycle ride. I just want to tell you. Anyway, it was a positive experience with some negativity, but I put the negativity aside. It was a largely positive experience.
It was warm up for this podcast, wasn't it? Don't worry. He was setting you up for this. So that's the negative bit is, if you want to look at it as negative. So the part I wanted to touch on was the way that the podcast was edited down to a short reel to advertise it. And I wanted to get your feedback on this. And the reaction from your face, Giles, is telling me pretty much everything that I want to know. Because they edited down a few sentences into a sentence. And I think the sentence he edited it down to said, the calorie tells you absolutely nothing, zero. When that didn't actually come out your mouth in one go, especially it was completely out of context. So I'd just love to kind of get your thoughts on that. And if you wanted to like tell us what you actually meant by the comment too.
Oh, okay. Okay. So let me tell you what I meant first. Mm. Okay. And then I'll tell you what I think about the whole con. I'm a pragmatist, incidentally.
Yeah.
So what I mean about the calorie is clearly the quality of the food that you're eating, the amount of protein, the amount of fiber. There is a big difference between 100 calories of chicken breast and 100 calories of sugar. You cannot and 100 calories of carrots. So I'm really sorry, but anyone who knows anything about nutrition, anyone who knows anything about the makeup of chicken versus donuts versus thingies understands that there is a big difference there, because calories tell you about the amount of food you're eating and the energy content of the food stuck in there. It doesn't tell you about the nutritional content of the food. Doesn't. The calories do not. And that's when I said, the calorie tells you zero, nothing. And what I meant there was it tells you nothing about the nutritional content of the food. Clearly, it tells you about the energy. And I think I might have prefaced it by saying that, look, I understand that 200 calories of potato chips is twice the portion of 100 calories of potato chips. Okay, so that's what I meant, as you guys would know, which is otherwise you wouldn't be having me on. But what was interesting was it went out, and part of the negativity was that then people thought I was some weird low carber. Not weird low carber. There are low carbers out there. I don't want to paint them.
Most of them are weird. Don't worry.
Don't want to paint them. But I'm a pragmatist. I know what I think. A large percentage of the people who heard me say that was going, what is he bollocks is he talking about? And ended up actually listening to the piece. Do I wish that he would have edited it a little bit better? Yes, because then. But did more? Do I think that more people ended up watching the whole interview so that they could actually listen to it? Because that probably did happen as well, rather than someone listening, okay, I got the information I need. And then, so I would always prefer to be quoted correctly, obviously, but I understand that his social media, because I don't think he's the guy that did the editing. He's hired people to do the editing. And if he hired people and their goal is, and their job description is to get as many people to watch and listen as possible, then they probably did succeed. So that is is that a terribly mercenary thing to say? But that is my take.
No,
at all, because we live in this world where you need short, snappy, clickbaity sound bites to get people to give their attention to the full amount of information. And even then, okay, I obviously listened to the full podcast. 2 hours is a long time. Giles, you have so much to say, but 2 hours is a long time to listen to anything. I was like, this is outrageously long. And I think that's why I came into this episode so overwhelmed, because I was like, oh, there's so many things to talk about. But we're not going to be here for 2 hours. We're going to be here for like 15 more minutes.
So. We're going to cut this down, Giles, to basically make it sound like you're calling out everyone who does low carb.
Yeah. That's it. You're just going to say the low carb weirdos. That's exactly what you're going to say. It's going to just going to say that I'm going to get lots more hate. Woo!
Excellent. I will actually say, just on that final point on that, Giles, is I did stick up for you in the comments section on so many personal trainers posts where they kind of watched it and then did a video calling you out because of the clickbaity title, and I did comment in a lot of them being like, please watch the full episode because this is not how it came across. So there we go. I did my part. You're welcome.
Thank you very much. But I understand it. I mean, and a couple of the comments saying, well, I wouldn't have allowed myself to be edited like that. I didn't have a a big choice. I guess I could have kicked up a fuss, but actually I did understand that more people watched it than not. And so I was, and this wasn't some sign. Yeah. I don't want to, that's my take. Yeah.
No, I think it was great. I think it allowed people to get some really helpful context and information around calories, around the food we consume, because there is this oversimplification of calories a calorie, you know, like, especially in this like fitness nutrition world. I'm not talking high level academics. I'm talking about, we're working with normal people on a day-to-day basis with their nutrition. There's a lot of oversimplified messaging around a calorie is a calorie, eat what you want, just stay in a calorie deficit if weight loss is your goal, or eat as many calories as you want if you're trying to gain weight, right? And it's just not that simple.
No.
On that note, I believe there's so much power in knowing how the food we eat impacts us, right? Like in understanding more about our food, because it makes us more educated consumers. It makes us more educated in our own nutrition, and it helps us be knowledgeable rather than holding this fear around food or working towards restriction as our only method of controlling our intake. And so we know there's no right diet, right? There's no right dietary approach. It's so individualized. But is there anything that genetics tells us that helps us understand the right approach for us?
So I think what the genetics at the moment, let me tell you with a cutting edge of what we know, is we're getting a better idea about the genetics of body weight. Okay, and the genetics of body weight is, by its definition, the genetics of, we now know, of how our brain influences our feeding behavior. Okay, so why some people like fattier foods versus sugary foods or whatever, okay? Sweet tooth, these are all real, why do I respond, why do I comfort eat, why do some people not? That kind of questions, okay? So those are where we are beginning to really understand some of the genes that are involved. We still don't know and understand everything, but we're beginning to get there. Now, what people are really, really interested in is to say, well, then can I take one of these tests, 23andMe or otherwise, and it tells me that this is the ideal diet for me. Now, a lot of these genetic testing companies are trying to sell this. And the answer is, I'm going to say not yet, rather than no. And the major issue is that we actually, in spite of all, but we managed to put human beings on the moon and we're flying things to Mars, but actually our ability to measure what we eat and how much we eat is actually very primitive. Food diaries. That's as close as we get, right, to what we eat. Or our energy expenditure, okay, which obviously is the measure of either heat or CO2 to O2 ratio, oxygen to carbon dioxide ratio. You can do all of this in the lab, okay, but you can't do it at scale. And when you want to do, like, millions of people, okay, not easily. And when you want to do good genetics of saying whether or not you will respond to a high protein diet versus a high fiber diet or versus a vegan diet, okay, but just as an example, then you gotta know not only what they're eating, what people are eating, how much they're eating, what they're expending before we get good genetics. And it's so simple, but yet so difficult, right? So I think we need to improve the technology of how we empirically measure how much and what an individual's eating. Now, I don't care if it's a burrito versus a pot noodle versus whatever it is. I care about how much fiber, protein, carbs, and fat has gone into you. That's the critical thing. And if we know that a bit more, then I think we'll get to the point where the genetics is there. We can measure genes in millions of people. We just need to be able to measure food intake accurately and energy expenditure accurately in millions of people. So I think we will get there at some point. I don't think we'll ever be able to predict if someone prefers oranges versus apples. That is just too specific a question. But do I think we'll get to a point where someone actually responds very well to a higher protein diet versus intermittent fasting, just to pick a couple of different dietary approaches that are out there? I think we probably will actually get to the point where we can say, look, the intermittent fasting diet for you, this is just not a good idea. And I think that's where we can get in maybe a decade from now, touching on wood. That would be my prediction.
That's quite soon, within a decade. Yeah.
I think so, because I think that we're getting better. Look, I a couple of things, right? In terms of measuring food intake, which has always fascinated me. Look, I don't think it's beyond the wit of Google or Amazon or whatever to design a little Bluetoothy type. Oh, we've got measurement things everywhere, you know, recording everything. Imagine if we had one in our stomach, just sitting there going, waiting to see what actually comes down. We all take, I have one of these godforsaken things. I'm really annoying and I take pictures of my food, okay? And so suddenly, you know you've had X, you know what macros you've suddenly eaten, okay, and how much fiber. You got the picture of the damn meal in front of you that you can then suddenly link up to yourself. Now we begin to get to have some really useful information. All of us have Garmins and Fitbits and Apple Watches. They're going to get better. So they're going to know how much we exercise. You put all that together, and I think we're going to get it. So I do think a decade is not actually too far away, because the genetic bit is done. We know how to do genetics. It's getting the environmental aspect to it that's really difficult.
And then I guess as well, with the prevalence of AI being more popular and widespread, that's just going to accelerate things as well.
That is going to accelerate it, because then you can imagine we're using something like AI where you can say, well, I'm going to analyze the last month of my diet. You sort of upload your Insta feed into an AI with whatever. I haven't invented this yet. No, I mean, you know, I know, but you know, and you kind of get that. You kind of get that thing or one of these things in, right? And you kind of put that in. And get AI to actually do it. This is why I'm saying I think a decade is a realistic thing. Actually, you can call me in a decade and says this is still not true, Giles. You lied to us. Yeah.
That gets me so excited as someone personally who's like very data driven, because right now we're at the expense of personal experimentation, right? Like we're trying to find a sustainable approach to our nutrition individually.
That's right.
Experimentation. There's no other way to get there than to kind of figure out what works for us. And I think, you know, Michael and I work in an industry where you want to call out bad diets and call out keto as bad or whatever. But for some, that is a sustainable approach. Not many. I'm going to go ahead and say that. Not a lot of people. But there is merit to all of these dietary approaches for the most part. We got to put a caveat there. And so to think of like this advancement in our ability to figure out what our intake looks like, along with advancing our ability to look at our output, is like, ooh, it's so exciting. Because that is a challenge in nutrition science right now, is you need a metabolic chamber to know any of this. And not many
so therefore you can only do it you can fit one person every 3 days. You know, like how many metabolic chambers do we have? In Cambridge, we only have three. Right. And so there are only like seven in this country or something. So I don't know how many, probably more than seven, but only a handful. Right. So it is just not, we just need, people are doing a lot of development of really high end, specific things. I think that we, as a broader industry, either nutrition or science, it doesn't matter. We work on the same things. We're trying to make people healthier. Okay, that's our goal through nutrition. That's what we're all trying to do through different ways. I think we need a better way of measuring food intake and energy expenditure accurately. And the moment we get that data will then help you. It will help me. Okay, for different reasons, but it will help, because then you'll be able to actually look at your client and say, okay, look, I know what you ate. I don't care what you told me. I know what you ate. This is what you ate. And then you can then give the advice. And likewise, when we want to do the genetics, we can then do it. And it's not imagined. We're not relying on somebody's memory about how much porridge they ate, you know, 4 weeks ago. And I think I think it will help everybody within our broader field to make someone's diet better.
Yeah, it's a really exciting time, isn't it? It's a really cool field to be a part of the nutrition world right now, and seeing what it's going to look like in another, like even like 2-3 years time. I feel like there's going to be so many big changes. And just on that as well, we're just to do like a bit of a 180, Giles. Mm. So with the kind of popularity rise, I don't know what you want to call it, of kind of body neutrality, body positivity, these kinds of groups on social media preaching or kind of shifting away from a focus on body weight. I'd just love to get your thoughts on that, especially with, because obviously I've heard you speaking in the past of us kind of having a genetic, not a genetic set point of exactly where our weight will be, but it'll be like a range that we can healthily move between. But then also talking about different diets as a way to lose weight. How do you kind of balance those two off, of us kind of focusing on nourishing our body, improving our diet, and focusing on weight loss? Like, where is the healthy balance there? Do you have a take on that?
I do have a take on it. I think even speaking as someone who does the genetics of body weight, which is what I study. Okay. I think we focus too much on weight. I think that the way to get around this is to focus on our health. Now, the problem is, and then our weight will sort of take care of itself. Going back to the opening conversation about this ride, there were people of different body sizes, different ages, people who had a pot belly, people who had slightly larger bottoms, whatever, but all of us finished the ride. Okay. And so were we there? No one lost weight because actually what happened was I sent out to our little WhatsApp group. One person lost like a couple of pounds. No one lost a single ounce, but all of us were healthy. And so I think that's what we got to do. I think we need to be think the problem, obviously, in today's society is there is a closely linked association in all our minds, okay, on all our primitive little minds with weight and beauty. It is, there is, okay? And I, ooh, she looks nice. Ooh, he lost weight. You look fabulous. And all of us say this. But I think we need to try and get into a more adult discussion of health. And then the moment you are healthy enough and you're not a model or you're not someone who you're sort of making money on your body, people do that and that's fine. Or an athlete, clearly you need to get. But even then, I think weight is unhelpful. Okay, like swimmers and things worrying about that. I think your health and your health vis-a-vis what you're planning on doing with your body. Now, if you are an Olympic swimmer, that's a very different question. Versus if you are a grandpa or grandma who wants to lift your grandchildren. Okay. Now, those are two goals. They require different elements to it, but they do require some level of health. And so that is what I think we need to do. Focus on health and then the weight will take care of itself.
I love that answer. And I'm really glad that you said that as well, Giles. Thank you. And so as like a trainer on social media, if you flick through my social media account, you follow me, Giles, it's fine. He doesn't, but I'm going to try and get you to follow me, Giles. There we go. So I purposefully try not to talk about weight loss, if at all, like much if at all, mainly because I feel like there's too much noise on social media already talking about weight loss. And I think people are overwhelmed and it's actually just a negative thing, constantly focusing on that one trait rather than focusing on behaviors that will improve our health in the long run. So I'm actually really glad that despite someone who talks about body size, genetics, obesity, to say that we need to shift the focus away from just talking about our weight is incredibly powerful. And that makes me very, very happy. So thank you.
And how do we get everyone on the same page of having an adult conversation? I love how you phrase that, because there is so much contention. There is so much black and white thinking. There's so much you have to live in a camp, whether it's health at every size or anti-diet or aesthetics is everything. You have to pick your camp, live in it, and then be so staunchly defendant of your beliefs that you are not open to conversation. Like it's impossible.
I don't think there's a shortcut. I really don't think there's a shortcut. This is slightly depressing. I don't think it is depressing. I just don't think there's a shortcut. Look, we're having this what I think is an adult, non-hysterical discussion, and we're talking about this and we're talking about that. It is undoubtedly true that if you are, that on a population basis, that if you are heavier and a higher BMI, you are more likely to be unhealthy. And if you have a lower BMI, you are less likely to be unhealthy. So that's a statement of truth, but that is just a statement of averages. And so we need to continue having things like this. You guys are making this podcast, you're going to put it out, and that's fab. I will say something about the Stephen Bartlett, the Diary of a CEO, is that he does interview a lot of people with really diametrically opposing views and contradicts just from one to the other. Is that good? Is that bad? Who am I to judge, right? But I think it's difficult to go on something. So if you are a subscriber and you listen to everything, who do you believe? Okay, do you believe the bald Chinese guy with moobs? Or which is smaller now since I've cycled. Or do you believe the person with a six pack? And I'm just saying, right? Or someone who looks beautiful, or someone who has a beach bod, or whatever. I'm not part of the marketing team. People do what they do. But we need to continue talking. We need to actually do this. Is the only way we're going to do it, when we actually have adult discussions about these things that are out there, so people can actually listen and go, oh, well, that does make sense. Makes sense to me.
It's hard. I think something that Stephen Bartlett said on the podcast was the more I learn, the less I know. I think he said like that exact quote around, you might have been talking with him about his experimentation with keto. And it was like, well, I thought this was the right way to do it, or something about gluten, you know, just something that's controversial and what have you. But that's definitely how this world of nutrition and food intake and obesity and fitness and health in general feels. Like, the more you know, the more confused you can be because of the opposition here. Michael, should we finish with our last question just so we wrap it up and keep it on time?
Yeah, let's do it. Go for it.
He giggled. We have, in promoting our podcast or in just talking about our podcast, Michael and I have called ourselves somewhat veterans in the industry, which I laugh at now because like we've both been working in fitness health for a decade. But you, Giles, have been doing this. You've been preaching your messages for a long time, right? How many years?
25 years.
5 years. A true veteran in the industry.
I feel
industry.
Like we need like a clap backing track.
True veteran in this space of promoting really incredible messages. Over the last 25 years, how have you seen messaging change? What, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of ways, but what are some of the ways you've seen messaging change around obesity or around what a diet should look like? Or maybe even what health is? There's a lot of questions, but maybe one of them.
It is a lot of questions. I think the first person I can think about is myself. And my thoughts have evolved immensely from when I first started, because obviously it would, why would it not? And evolved to what I think now versus all of us judge. We do judge. We're human beings, right? And so I found myself judging. I now try and use people first language, for example, where someone with obesity rather than an obese person, because that's the same as calling someone cancerous rather than with cancer. That's the analogy. And so I've seen that evolve to myself. And I think that's helpful. And I can say that, look, I didn't use that language before. I use that language now. And so I think I'm better for it. And so that's what I do. I do think it has gotten better, but I think we have a seriously long way to go. I think there are people, and interestingly, speaking to the non-expert is a lot easier, actually, through this medium, through speaking to the person in a restaurant or on these cycle rides or what have you. The real difficult people to reach are the people who think they know better. Policymakers, other professionals within the field. And interestingly, those doctors, okay, I'm not a clinician myself, but I have clinicians, and they are also not all of them, obviously, but many of them are part of the problem. Where they are liable to judge when a patient with obesity walks into their clinic, they're going to go, look, Mr. Smith, what are you doing? You know, blah, 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 blah. Preach, 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 preach. And so I think that what I've spent a lot of my time, certainly the past 5-6 years doing, are speaking to people like that, speaking to policymakers. I have a larger platform, so I have access to some of these folks teaching the medical profession. And that's what I'm trying to do now. I try and speak to primary care practitioners, those likely to see people coming in with obesity. And I try to get as much access to policymakers through my policymaking colleagues and otherwise as possible to kind of get the message out to them so that when they craft the health policies around diets, around calorie labeling, around whatever, that at least they're getting some science inserted. And I think that's the way to do it. I have found it easier to speak of what I do over the past 25 years, but there's a long way to go.
So on that then, what would be your ideal kind of future of health promotion? Like, what do you think that looks like? And then how would genetics mix in with that as well?
Okay, so I think undoubtedly the most important thing at the moment, and this is speaking as a biologist, okay? I studied the biological variation, why different people respond to different diets. But the thing that would make the biggest difference now is to solve poverty, okay? And because at the moment, the healthiest, the cheapest foods are not the healthiest foods. They're just not. On average, people say a lentil is cheap. A lentil is cheap as a lentil, but how much heat and energy does it take to cook the lentil or the beans? How much knowledge is required to make it tasty? Will you actually eat it versus sticking something in a microwave? Just as an example, okay? So you use only 2 minutes of heat rather than 2 hours of a pot on a stove. Some people don't have that money. And that's why people who are on the lowest quintile of society are twice as likely to have obesity than people like us, okay? Middle sort of professional class people, okay? Not rich people by any means, but professional class people. And so I think we need to make the healthy option the cheaper, easier option so that equitably all of us have healthier diets. First thing, because that will then in very many ways remove that doubling of obesity. Then for all of us people who have choices, we can begin to talk about fiber and protein and blah, blah, blah. And we do need to talk about that. But the absolute emergency is the criminal nature of it, where, look, there's no difference between rich and poor people genetically. None. Zero. Accident of birth. Okay? So if that's the case, then it's all about the environment, all about access to a healthier diet. Let's make the healthier diets cheaper. That is the first thing I will do. And once we get that sorted, we can come back and talk about everything else. That's my take.
And the way that you answer that, Giles, is exactly why we love you and why we wanted you on this podcast, because it sums it up perfectly. Yeah.
It's a noble mission.
Yeah, it is.
I went back to Baptist preacher.
No, we need it. I mean, yeah, I just as a resident of the UK, we know how awful things are here at the moment, without going too political and too deep. So I think until that happens, there's really not going to be any strides forward. So a perfect point. And just to wrap it up, Giles, is there anything that you're doing at the moment you want people to go and listen to, go and read, or tell us what you've got going on, and we'll plug it all in the show notes for you.
Do I have anything going on at the moment? I don't think I have anything. I mean, happening at the moment. It's just a terrible thing to say, except for my science. Pardon?
Two really incredible books that you wrote.
I do have two books. My first one is called Gene Eating, which is the science of fad diets, and the second one is Why Calories Don't Count. And if you got to read it for the nuance, and those are available where all good books are sold.
Brilliant. And I have both of those books and they are brilliant. So everyone listening, go and buy them. You won't regret it. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Giles. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
See you next week.